Welcome everyone to another episode of Kiwi Talks. My guest today is probably best known for his tenure at id Software, though he has worked on prestigious franchises such as Doom, Halo, James Bond, Tony Hawk, and more. I'd like to welcome Sean Green. How you doing? Thanks for being here, all the way from Japan. So I suppose the good place to start off with is, how did you end up at id Software?
The whole story is one of those, it's definitely one of those right place, right time type of stories.
Oh, so I love those.
Yeah, I met John and the other id guys while I was working at Apogee Software.
Nice.
You know, guys who made Duke Nukem and all those other games that we remember from when all this just kind of started to explode. You know, in 1990, Scott Miller was looking for somebody to come on as a permanent employee to take phone orders, do technical support, and things like that. And my connection to him was through Scott's sister. I had gone to school with Scott's sister. She knew that I was into computers and had done some programming, you know, earlier. So she had mentioned me. I went and interviewed with Scott, and you know, that was pretty easy, and ended up getting hired. So, you know, for the first couple of years of Apogee's, you know, rise to popularity, if you ordered any of their games or sought out technical support, you probably spoke to me.
You were that guy.
I was the guy, and it literally was, you know, something that kind of exploded. Like, once those guys got busy, and they hired me, I was literally, you know, 8 a.m. in the morning. There were, you know, phone calls waiting already, and was literally on the phone from the time I got there in the morning till the time I left, just constant stream of people wanting to order Commander Keen. I don't know if you remember Commander Keen and the history with all that, but
yeah,
you know, the game was so revolutionary that like everybody, you know, was calling to order. And honestly, for me, that kind of affected my future as well. Because at the time I was studying hardware, because I wanted to do something, you know, on the hardware side of things. And, you know, once I saw Keen, I was just blown away, you know, because this was Nintendo quality game, with side scrolling and great graphics and great colors and, you know, better than anything I had seen on the PC. And immediately, for me, I changed my mind from wanting to do hardware to wanting to get back into programming and learn how to make games on the PC. You know, working at Apogee, I worked with Scott for the next 2 years. Watching the release of Wolfenstein, and was, you know, helped do a lot of testing on Wolfenstein during development for that. And then, you know, Apogee grew and got bigger. And then in 1993, January of 1993, id Software, you know, because of differences and some issues with Apogee, decided to leave and publish on their own. And so basically the conversation there with Scott was, you know, hey, we're leaving and we're taking Sean with us. So in 1993, I went to work for id, you know, up in the big black cube and in Mesquite, and during that era. So yeah, started at it in 1993 is when all that.
And so when you started it, Ed, what was the first thing that you did?
I mean, initially it was really just because Doom at that time was very early in stages of development. So it was really just kind of like learning the editor that John had written, John Romero. So learning the editor, learning the tools, learning the pipeline for grabbing data and putting it into the engine and adding new assets and things like that. Learning a little bit of level design. I was more interested in the programming side of things. So, one of the things I did was basically, tried to write duplicates of the tools that those guys had had for their pipeline, like the image grabber, which basically, it would take like an LBM screen from Deluxe Paint, and you would kind of like draw a rectangle around it to grab the coordinates. And then the tool, it would dump out a text file with coordinates for all the images. And then the tool would, look at those coordinates for the images and then grab them, put them in the engine format, and then stick them in the WAD file.
Ah, I see. So, how did you end up doing all the ports then? Because you pretty much managed that pipeline, didn't you?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. So during my time at id, I didn't really have a specific niche that I fell into. Everybody there wore a lot of hats, just because the company was so small at the time. But I think I probably wore the most just out of necessity, right? So like if a machine needed to be built, I would do that.
You were the guy.
I was the guy to do that. Just random stuff like, hey, the WAD file needs to be updated with these new graphics, so I would do that. Online support, and just having like online presence for the company, which back then it was like CompuServe and AOL and bulletin boards and things like that. So providing an online presence for that. I had done a few levels, here and there for different projects. But then, towards the end of my tenure, when we started doing the ports, that was kind of a whole that existed that I could easily fill. So that's how I kind of ended up falling into managing all the ports and things like that. And I had been there probably the most, and it just made sense because I was familiar with all of the levels. I mean, by this time, I had played Doom so many times and Doom 2 so many times that, it just kind of knew all the levels like the back of my hand. So, yeah, so it just made
Made
sense,
sense. Yeah.
for me to do that.
So, but when we talk about a port, like what's the thing that you focus on the most when you're looking at porting something from, say, PC to whatever platform?
Yeah, I mean, obviously performance was one. And then, the next probably would be retaining as much as possible the original gameplay. But, on most of these platforms, due to memory constraints, the levels are the first things that are going to get chopped up. So it was really just kind of this balance between maintaining the original gameplay, being able to fit on the platform, and cutting those levels up in such a way where they were still fun and still playable, and the overall experience was still an id experience, right?
And I suppose it's a lot of trial and error.
Yeah, I mean, you can make a lot of logical decisions when you're looking at the levels, in the editor. There are definitely, some areas that you could look at and you can say, okay, well, this is a moment in the level, and that's fairly important, so like let's try to keep that in here and maybe trim down the path from, each of the moments to each other, or reduce complexity in the levels between there. But it's really about trying to maintain, those moments and, those kind of things that make the level cool, right? Like, and by moments I mean things like the monster closets that everybody knows about, and just all those kind of important encounters, right?
Yeah, makes sense. Because you got to do some design though, right, on Ultimate Doom and Doom 2.
I did.
But was that a case of them just coming to you and be like, here, design a level?
Kind of. It was basically, so like, for Ultimate Doom, we wanted that, to kind of be a special thing. So we kind of like we wanted, John to do his levels, American to do his levels, and then I would do some levels. And by that time, as I said, I'm more interested in engineering side of things than I am the design side of things. So that's kind of where I spent most of my time. But then, by the time Ultimate Doom came out, I had a little bit better design chops than I did when the initial Doom was released, right? And plus, by that time, Doom had evolved to a point where we were no longer designing or creating the look and feel of things, right? By that time, Doom and Doom 2 had already been released. And so it's fairly easy to look at that and say, okay, this is, the look and feel of Doom. And so, creating something that fits within that, already existing kind of scheme and modality is just, it's much easier than creating it from scratch, right? Which is, in the beginning when we were first making Doom, you're creating the look and feel from scratch, so it's fairly nebulous at that point. And so a lot of the stuff that I did in the beginning didn't really fit in the direction that that we were creating. So but yeah, I mean, once Doom and Doom 2 are out, it's like, okay, this is easy to like replicate something in this universe.
But they must have had some trust in you because you did the final level on Thy Flesh Consumed. Well, you did two levels. Yeah. So, but you got to handle the final level.
Yeah, I mean, it just kind of ended up that way.
But did you feel much pressure at the time? Like, okay, this is the final level of this chapter. I have to nail this.
No, not really. I
Okay, that's
mean,
good.
the flow, honestly, the flow was kind of, we took the levels, and after playing them for some while, or for some time, we kind of like looked at it and said, okay, this is what the flow will be. So it wasn't, it wasn't the kind of
So,
thing where it's
I
like,
see.
okay,
So it wasn't set out
John's
as the
gonna,
final level.
right.
It
Yeah, it
was
wasn't
kind
like
of, yeah.
John's going to take the first two levels, where American's going to take the middle levels, and then you'll take the final. So it's more like, it's kind of like when you're creating an album, right? Like you make a bunch of songs, and then you figure out, okay, what order of songs feels the best. And it was kind of the same way. Like we played these, everybody created their levels, and we played the levels, and it's like, okay, what feels best for this? And mine just kind of fell where they were.
So I guess then when you work out where it's going to be placed in terms of where in the chapter, then when it was decided that that would be the last level, then they'd add in what additional monsters and the spider mastermind, and is that how it all happened? Because obviously when you're first designing it, you wouldn't know that it's going to be the last level, so you're not going to put like a boss monster at the end, are you? So.
Well, I mean, it depends too. You know, a lot of that has to do with level design style and things like that. Like my style is to kind of, you know, sketch out the level in the beginning to get an idea of like, okay, what feels like a good shape. And then, you know, you go through and you create your build up and you create your simple things like ammo gathering and all those other things. And then you just, once the player has, you know, a decent amount of ammo and things like that, you create your moments like with your monster closets and things like that. And then, you know, at the end, like for me personally, I try to create, you know, something big at the end that's challenging. And you know, this was at a time where people had already played Doom, so you know, the levels obviously are going to be a little bit more difficult, right? So you know, so having like a boss at the end was a little bit more common. You know, at that point in time, it was just kind of a thing like, yeah, let's make this a little hard. It wasn't necessarily like a conscious design decision because we knew that it was going to be the end of the, you know, the final level.
Did it give you a whole new appreciation for what some of those other designers did, from like Sandy Peterson and John Romero and American McGee, those guys? Like, were you like, oh my gosh, this is way harder than I thought it would be?
No, I mean, I tried to make levels for the first, you know, for the first few episodes, and I knew it was hard. I knew it was difficult. So, you know, just like the, you know, from my first attempts at the first episodes of Doom to my last attempts, you know, a lot of it was just kind of like watching what these, you know, those guys were doing, and you know, just kind of making smart decisions based off of, you know, the foundation that those guys had already made. But I mean, I knew from, you know, the first time you sit down with the editor and you start with a blank screen, you know, at least for me, it's kind of like, oh yeah, this is hard. You know, like, okay, here's nothing. Make something fun, right? So yeah, I mean, I kind of knew from the beginning that, you know, it was a difficult task, and like what, you know, kind of what those guys went through, and you know, when they were making levels, you know, and plus I was, you know, I was housed in the same room. Like American and I shared an office for a while, and you know, I would see him making stuff, and you know, actually it, during some of the ports too, John and I were in the same office, so it's like watching those guys do it, and you know, watching, you know, just kind of how involved they are when they're actually, you know, making the levels. It's like, yeah, these guys are, you know, these guys are like craftsmen.
What's the number one thing you think you learned from John Romero?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I don't necessarily know that there was one thing I learned from John. I would have to say, like, John's, you know, in my opinion, John's kind of most redeeming quality is his resilience. You know, and this even, you know, this kind of goes beyond just like any kind of work ethic or anything like that. You know, just like, you know, as a human, John is a really resilient guy, right? You know, all throughout id Software, and then, you know, I worked with John for a few years at Ion. You know, and all during that time, there was so much stuff that went on at Ion. You know, with drama and teams quitting and all these things happening. Like, John never lost sight of kind of what the goal was. And yet he also never lost his positive attitude. Like, he's, you know, kind of one of the, he's one of the most positive people I've ever met, right? Like, he's, you know, when things are going bad, he's just kind of like, he ignores the drama. He doesn't engage in any of that stuff. He just kind of like focuses on getting whatever project he's working on done. Like, what's the problem in front of me? And he never really let, just kind of all the outside drama and things like that deter him. And he's always, he's just always remained like a super positive guy, not only in work related stuff, but just like, just like life in general, I'm in the middle of reading Doomguy right now, and it's really interesting to see because I knew a lot of that stuff, but kind of we only ever skimmed the surface. But just to kind of see like all the stuff that he's been through and how he's maintained positivity, it's pretty admirable
I find
in
that
my
stuff quite
eyes.
infectious, like positive people, because then it
Yeah,
makes you very positive, and I think that's really important in a team environment. If you have a leader that's like that, because then you notice it when they leave, you're like, ah, oh, it can
And
really affect the morale.
it was that was kind of like one of the things when we were at ID. Romero is like super fun guy to hang out with, and he's also productive. But then when he left, the next personality was John Carmack, who's this,
Very different.
very serious guy. He's got a work ethic that nobody can match. So for me, when John left, it kind of left a big hole at ID. And it was it was just kind of like, I felt it was time for me to go, and luckily John gave me a place to go, not that there's anything wrong with, Carmack's work ethic. Obviously it's been this amazing thing and kind of a
It's like yin and
phenomenon,
yang. I kind of feel like John
it
Romero and
was.
John Carmack, like they brought the best out of each other because they were
Yes,
opposites and they had their different
absolutely.
strengths and weaknesses.
And like I've to this day, I've never worked on a team that worked so well together. I think, when John left, it was really unfortunate because, the chemistry that those guys had and their ability to work and get something done so quickly, to me, that was my first experience. So I just thought that's the way it was. Right. But then, like going to other companies, it was just not like that, I
So
haven't
you
really
started to
worked in.
appreciate it more as time went on.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, because I suppose you don't know what you don't know. So
Absolutely.
yeah, so your first main gig, you're with Ed and with John, and then you go off somewhere else, and then you end up appreciating what you had.
Yeah, totally.
It goes to show how important the morale of a team is and how they really need to be a cohesive unit, but then the leader does have a ripple effect on the entire team.
It does, but honestly, the thing that was unique about ID was there wasn't really a leader. All those guys worked really well together, as peers and equals. And I think it was just a unique situation because at that time, Adrian and Kevin, were working on their own specific part of art. John Romero was working on coding utilities and level design. John Carmack was working on the technology. American was working on levels. Sandy was working on levels. Tom was working on design. So everybody kind of had their own set of tasks that they had ownership over, right? And the communication was good. So it was really, just kind of this free-flowing creative environment, where nobody really stepped on anybody else's toes. And I think because of that, you know, they were able to get a lot of stuff done very efficiently. You know, everybody had their own thing that they owned.
Do you think that has
And
something to do with the fact that it was a small team as well? Because obviously, when a team starts to balloon, then you typically need someone to kind of manage the structure. So communication doesn't
absolutely.
get lost.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and you know, that's specifically why I mentioned the communication, right? The communication was pretty good. I mean, you know, these guys are in offices right next to each other. You know, Carmack and Romero were right next to each other. So it's like if they need to discuss something, Carmack or, you know, Romero would just walk 10 feet and, you know, talk to the other one and hash it out and get it done. There's, you know, it's you know, running a company is one of these funny things. Like as you get more people, you need more management. But then as you have more management, you know, things get more convoluted and more difficult, right? You know, we're at a point now where, you know, in a lot of these companies you had managers of managers, and you know, it just kind of like, you know, I think there's a better way. But you know, it's hard. It's also hard too, because on the other side, the scope of these projects, you know,
It's massive.
that are being done today are so much larger. You know, I think Doom was like a 9 month project, which is just ridiculous if you think about it.
And how many of you were there? Weren't many. How big was
No,
the
no, no.
team?
Yeah, so it was Kevin, Adrian, Tom, Sandy, John, American. So that's like seven people, right?
Which is unbelievable in this day and age. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just
But I
wouldn't happen
mean,
unless it was an indie studio.
like, you know, Carmack's a monster. You know, like you look at how quickly he was developing tech, and you know, like looking back on it now, knowing exactly what was involved. I mean, you know, when we came out with the or when John came out with the BSP visibility solution, you know, that was like he's like did that over a weekend, right? He, you know, he rewrote the entire visibility solution in a weekend, right? So, you know, John Carmack has always had like a real clear vision of like what possibilities were available, you know, in terms of like solutions for problems and things like that, and how those could potentially be integrated. And you know, he was always just really quick, you know, to get an idea implemented. Yeah, that just always kind of blew me away.
Isn't he a bit of a workaholic though as well? Like he's just in it all the time. I mean, that's my understanding of him. But
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I mean, 'cause the whole workaholic thing, you know, that kind of like, you know, that kind of gets grouped in with like crunch and all that other stuff, but
I think that yeah, they are. I suppose that line can blur, but
The funny thing is, like, the thing that I always noticed about crunch and about the hours that you're working is, like, you know, the circumstances under which you're having to work those hours. If you're, you know, driven and you're in a really creative place, you know, I count code as a creative thing, you know. So, like, you know, when you're really driven and you're in this really creative place, and you know, you've got kind of a flow state going, I think, you know, the hours pass by much easier, right? And even a lot of times without intent, right?
oh, yeah, so it's self-inflicting.
Yeah, it is self-inflicting, but at that point it's not really detrimental, because you know, the psychological impact of it, it's not negative, because it's not being forced upon you, right? You're doing it kind of your own drive, right? Like you've got this thing, you've got this idea, you want to get it done. And so, you know, the psychological and the stressful impact of it is much less than, for example, if, you know, your manager tells you, hey, Team A is working crunch, so you're working crunch, right?
Yeah, totally.
So, but he does work a lot. He does work a lot. I don't know if maybe workaholic, you could say that, but yeah, he works a lot, but I think it's just 'cause, he's a really driven guy, and when he's got an idea about something, he's just very quick and very diligent about putting it out there and implementing it, and, just kind of getting it out into reality.
But these high-level success stories, in regards to anyone, it usually comes with some level of sacrifice, right? I mean,
Sure.
John
Yeah,
Carmack
of
is
course.
John Carmack because of what he's done to become John Carmack, right?
Everything in life is an exchange, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. For him, I think he had all this inertia early on in his life. And during that time, all this technology and game development were the only things that he had going on, right? So he like he focused on those things early on in life, and then later on in life focus on other things, right? Because, so he's been able to, he got married and has had a family and raised a family and all those other things, but that happened like much later in life, right? So early on he had the time to where he didn't affect anybody external to him, right? So he was just by himself, and he could do those kinds of things. And because he was driven, and because it was something that was kind of a creative desire for him to write all this technology and things like that, I don't think like the mental impact probably wasn't as negative as you might think, right?
Well, as you mentioned before, if it's self-inflicted and you're doing it on your own accord, I think it is different from a manager being like, you have to work 110 hours a week or whatever. And you mentioned time, but I think a big thing for programmers is time. And programmers, I would think, have a period where they kind of get in the zone. You have to get into a bit of a zone, and then when you're in the zone, you want to make sure that you stay in the zone and time's just not even a thing. Do you recall, like, what's the longest period you kind of got into a zone and then lost track of time? Like,
Yeah, I mean, that happened pretty frequently, less at id and more as I got into engineering and things like that. I mean, definitely had a lot of those moments at IonStorm working on Daikatana. Definitely had those moments at Gearbox working on some of those projects and things like that. So yeah, definitely can remember a lot of times,
What was it bad when you were working on Halo, or was that a good time? Like,
Halo was a really fun project. And I think it also had a lot to do with the people I was working with. Like, really enjoyed working with all the guys at Gearbox. And Halo was, probably, I would say Tony Hawk and Halo were the funnest projects there, just because of the team and the interactions there. And it was early in the studio's lifetime. We were still kind of scrappy, and we could communicate with each other, and there wasn't like a lot of that whole management thing
okay, so
going
there's
on,
no
right?
hierarchy, really.
Not really. No, not at all. And I think like the only hierarchy we had on Halo was that we had to split into two teams, platform team, which I was heading, and then there was the network team, just because the network for Halo was so such a big project. Like, those guys basically rewrote all the networking. So
Wow. So you did realize the gravity of what you were working on when you were working on the Halo port.
That was great. Yeah, we're really excited with it. Microsoft, I don't really know the details of why they pitched us on it originally. Because so at the time we were working on a project for them, and they were just kind of like funding a first playable for a project, which will go unnamed.
Fair
So,
enough.
at the same time, they're like, "Hey, we've got Halo. You guys want to give it a shot?" And of course, me, like, I'm all about problem solving and doing fun stuff. And ports at the time were kind of my thing. Like, I just had to be really good at porting stuff. Like, we had just come off Tony Hawk, and it was me, another engineer that came to Gearbox with me from Ion Storm, and a designer. And we had just come off Tony Hawk that we did in like 6 months, so it was a real quick project. And I was kind of like ready for the next challenge, and they mentioned Halo. I'm like, dude, of course, yeah, absolutely. So it was funny, I ended up porting the base version over a weekend, and
Is that
getting,
all? Wow.
well, Xbox is really just a Windows machine,
Yeah, I suppose that's true. Yeah.
but there were some kind of tricky things that we did to just kind of like get it up and running quickly. But yeah, generally it was it's Blamlib, which is what Bungie had used for, like, going all the way back to Oni and all those games. So it was fairly mature source base. It's pretty well written. When you're dealing with good code, a lot of times it's easy if you can see, what you're looking for is like the differences. Like, okay, what are the things that I care about that I need to change to get this running from platform A to platform B? And so, like, that's kind of how I approached the problem. And like, there were really only a few things that needed to be, changed to get it up and running from the Xbox to the PC. So we had like this, by the end of the weekend, we had this flat shaded version of Halo up and running. And yeah, it was super exciting. And then the next steps were, just doing research, which really just kind of involved us playing a bunch of Halo, playing
Research,
with the
yeah.
physics. Yeah, I mean, the physics for Halo were great, and it was, that was a game in and of itself. It's like, okay, put another sticky grenade here, and let's see if we can pop it up over the arch, and just, all these, just physics games. And, again, more research,
Yeah. Can you play a game and enjoy it just as a game, or do you go into your or put your programming hat on and start thinking of all the things in terms of what's going on behind the scenes or what you would do, or do you be in awe of certain like physics engines, for example, within games, or are
Yeah,
you just
I tend
enjoying
to
it
do
as it
both.
is? Okay,
I
you do
mean, like,
both.
I can have a lot of fun playing it and be like, oh, I want, how did they do that, particular thing or that particular effect or whatever. So, all this development stuff has gotten so crazy. Like, the stuff that
Oh,
people are
yeah.
doing these days is just amazing. So, it's really cool to see, just how far all this is advanced, and what all these amazing talents are doing with games these days. So yeah, definitely. I don't really play as much as I used to, just, because
It
I've
happens.
been on break from that, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, I still pay attention to the industry, and when I see something really neat, I just kind of like, I just love seeing the stuff people are coming up with. Yeah.
I think the thing that blew my mind in terms of physics lately was Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom. I'm not sure if you played that, but just
Love
in terms,
Zelda. I'm a huge Zelda fan.
But like the physics in terms of like creating stuff and the fact that no glitches and bugs and nothing breaks. I mean, I saw a whole bunch of programmers on Twitter when it released and they're like, how the hell does this even work?
I mean, it's I consider, you know, the latest Zelda a masterpiece. You know, it's like, you know, just from kind of a technical standpoint, what they tried to achieve and what they did achieve and just how solid it is. And you know, it's kind of like you said, it's like, because there's a lot of generic stuff that can just happen from, you know, for example, lumping a bunch of objects together, right? And they've done that and got it all to, you know, behave, if you will, you know. So it's, it's agree. I mean, there's like, you know, infinite number of permutations. Like, there's no way to test a lot of this stuff.
Well,
So,
that's right. That's why it doesn't, it just surprises me. You know, a game of that size can release with pretty much close to no glitches or bugs or game-breaking things. I mean, the amount of QA that must have been done on that is crazy.
Crazy.
Because obviously you're well-versed in QA. What's the most common thing when you're doing QA for a project? What's the most common problem that occurs?
Man, I don't know if there's such a thing.
I suppose every project's different, right? But like you did a lot of the QA for Final Doom, didn't you? So what was a common
Well, most,
bug that would come up?
I mean, there wasn't really like a common bug. You know, for Final Doom, it was really about maintaining a specific level of quality and just trying to come close to doing things the id way, if you will. You know, like just having, you know, solid contiguous themes, you know, and not just kind of like, you know, like look and feel is very important, right? So look being like, you know, solid themes and motifs and, you know, not just a lot of random textures and things like that. Texture alignment is kind of a huge thing. You know, that's fairly common to see, like, oh, you've got like you're 2 pixels off right there, so you know, can you adjust that, you know? But yeah, I mean, there wasn't really any one particular thing that stood out a lot, at least from what I remember. The biggest thing with the ports in general was always about playability and maintaining level flow and things like that. So playability is fairly huge, and that's like something that we're always looking for, you know, or we were always looking for.
So in your opinion, what would you say is the hardest thing about programming?
The hardest thing is finishing.
Is that just because like you can always find stuff that you can improve on and you know there's a deadline and someone is coming along and saying, "Nope, you're done with
Yeah.
this."
Well, it's for a lot of reasons too. I mean, there's definitely, you know, again, you know, I see coding as an art. So, you know, there's that whole part of like making sure that a thing is done and intending, you know, it works as the way you intended it to. But generally, I mean, just finishing in general is difficult. You know, because a lot of things tend to pile up at the end of the project. You know, that's kind of where a lot of the really important work happens, you know. Like, you know, the whole 80-20 rule and all that.
And is
But
there,
it's like, yeah, go
because
ahead.
I was going to say, because one of the things with programming, I would think, is you'd probably think that you have a rough idea of how long something's going to take. But then once all the pieces are connected together, there's a whole bunch of curveballs that occur, and then something that you thought would take 3 days can take 3 weeks.
Yeah, I think that happens a lot, but that's usually with new things. If you're, experience plays a big role in a lot of that. Like one of the things that I learned that, a lot of people don't think about is, integration is a really important aspect of coding and writing features and things like that. And, a lot of engineers and a lot of producers and, guys who are writing these schedules tend to look at features in a vacuum.
True.
So it's like, yeah, feature X will take 3 days to implement, kind of in a vacuum, but integrating it into the game, also takes some time too. So a lot of people tend to forget the integration aspect of things. So that's like, that's really kind of one of those things that only comes with experience, is like once you've done that a few times and you've missed some dates because of that, you kind of tend to take that into account of like, okay, it's going to take me, this long to get this feature up and running in, my demo level, or my prototype or whatever, my sandbox. But then like integrating it as an actual feature into the engine is also going to take this much time, and this, this has to be done, that has to be done, so on and so forth. So
So when you ventured off on your own and you founded Escalation Studios, and that was your baby, were there a lot of things that caught you off guard about actually having your own studio?
not really. A lot of the things involved with development, I was already familiar with, running teams, management, those kinds of things. I think really the big things that kind of throw you off are, because I founded the company with a friend of mine from the industry, Tom Mustaine, who had just come off of running Ritual Studios for 10 years, right? So, like finding common ground with your partners is always, that's kind of like a continuous task, if you will. And I tend to, I tend to be kind of a stubborn guy and like to dig my heels in for the things that I want. So, coming to compromises and things like that, I had to learn how to do that. And yeah, so I think, really like the aspect of working with others on that capacity, on that high level of running a company was something I had to learn. And all that. So that was probably like the biggest kind of unknown or, thing that it, didn't really think about, or hadn't experienced when I started the company, or when we started the company,
Speaking of unknowns, what are your thoughts on AI and how it will play into programming?
AI. Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not for or against AI. I think it can be a really useful tool. It's going to be one of these really interesting things where we need to, as a practical usage of AI on a team, like you're going to need to find the sweet spot, right? And by the sweet spot, I mean, like, is this going to, take me longer to take what the AI does and clean it up? Or is it easier for me to just write it myself? You're always going to have resident experts who can look at what the AI generates and call it out on whether it's a good implementation or not. I've used AI for code generation for like some boilerplate stuff just to kind of see how it does. And it's fairly impressive right now, but It's I imagine it would be expensive, to change, when an API changes, like do you have to rebuild the model? How expensive is that? What's the energy cost for that? But there's a lot of factors, but I don't think smart people are going anywhere. You're always going to need resident experts. And if you just like try to start a studio with a bunch of newbie guys who were going to use AI for the majority of code generation, I don't think it's going to work out for you.
Yeah, I mean, there's always people that I suppose kind of abuse new technology, I feel. Like, I think it's good as a tool. Yeah.
It's but it's not, and having run a company, I understand the desire to save money, but you also have to understand when you run a company that money is not your only cost, right? There's a cost for not hiring experienced people, right? You can't just throw bodies at a problem and add in some AI and think that it's going to go well. So, I think we're probably going to have to rewrite the Mythical Man Month to take into account AI, and the end result is still going to be the same. It's like throwing bodies, and now throwing bodies plus AI at the problem is not going to solve it, in the way that you think it is.
I agree. I just think the people in the suits are going to do it anyway, or attempt it.
Of course, yeah,
Yeah.
and it's it's similar to the cycle that we've experienced over the past 20 years. Things have become more managed. There's more overhead. I really appreciate the kind of the piece that Carmack wrote when he was discussing leaving Meta, right? And like how long it takes those guys to get stuff done just because of all the bureaucracy and all this other stuff. And it's like, there's again, there's a sweet spot, at which, thing A is useful, thing B is useful, but maybe thing C doesn't fit into the equation as much as you think it does. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see what people learn about, finding that sweet spot and, using AI in a useful way and not just like completely depending upon it to solve all their money problems or, get them investors or whatever.
I wanted to ask you, because you live in Japan, you're in this unique scenario where you kind of have an understanding of Western development philosophy, but you're probably getting exposed to a lot of Japanese development philosophy at the moment as well, and where you sit with it, right? Because it seems to me that Japan seems to be in a lot better position to navigate the future of development than the West, because you're not really hearing about layoffs and all that sort of stuff like you are in the West, which is really bad at the moment.
I mean, it's very interesting. I think Japan hasn't really changed their design philosophies since all of this, began back in the late 70s and early 80s and all of that. From what I've experienced and seen, the Japanese focus on the quality and experience of the product. And, the West tends to be geared more towards, pleasing investors and, increasing the numbers. One of the reasons that I've kind of backed off from the industry a bit is, when I left in 2012, the focus at that point was less about making a fun game and, more about like, how many microtransactions can we create Right. And for me, like, I've been playing games since I was 8 years old, and the fun is what I love. I don't, I'm not really a big fan of like the whole business side of it where, profits are the bottom line. And from what I see from, the Japanese philosophy, like, definitely they take that stuff into account, but they also know how to balance it with making a good game. I mean, Zelda is a great example, right? That's a great game. Those guys, Zelda was delayed 2 or 3 times, and there's no microtransactions in Zelda. There's no loot boxes. There's nothing like that,
And
so I
Zelda's
think
bigger than
that's,
it's ever been as well.
it's just crazy. I think it's really just a matter of philosophy and what your desire is. I mean, surely there are lots of game dev studios who are about, gameplay and all those things in the West. But the thing is, publishers aren't putting their money there because, there's no formula, right? You can't predict a hit.
No.
We've seen lots of examples of that where, like, hey, who knew that this particular game was gonna explode the way it did? That's great. Let's copy it. So it's there's not like any investment in innovation, right? Nobody wants to take the risk because they're dealing with high numbers and they've got to appease their investors, things like that. So, and I get that, but it's like, if you want to do something new and great, you have to have, you've got to have some risk, right? And you've got to put faith in your team. If you have an experienced team, like, put your faith in those guys, and support those good ideas. Invest in gameplay, invest in, what this is all about. This is all about like games and fun and community. And, making it all about like profits and cash, is it doesn't feel great,
Well, it doesn't seem sustainable either because
No. I mean,
budgets are inflating, but the rate of return doesn't justify it. I mean, there was that Sony leak where like Spider-Man 2 cost like 300 million and they had to sell
yeah,
like
that's
seven
crazy.
and a half million units to break even. I'm like, what?
Yeah, that's crazy.
That seems crazy. Yeah.
But you also, I mean, you also look at what's going on with over the past couple of years, like all these companies have been focused on building their coffers, and the way that they've done that is through creating the appearance that they're innovating and they're doing great things by like, oh, we need to hire tons of people and, expand our studios, or Google needs to expand their employee base because they're working on so many great things to pull in, investor interest and investor money. And then 2 years later, they fire all those people because most of them were doing nothing anyway. But their stock price went up, and the impact that those layoffs had on their stock price is, it's not large enough to counteract, all the money that they raised prior to that, right? So it's like, you just have this investor game going on where, you're fooling investors into thinking that you're creating something, and you're creating buzz to get investors to invest and hiring people. But then, you eventually reach a point where it's not sustainable. Like you said earlier, that kind of behavior is not sustainable. And, as a company, just like, oh, well, we just need to lay some people off. But then, like, those are actual lives that you're impacting in a really heavy way, right? So you've brought all these people in, almost kind of like family, and you've got mouths to feed. You're paying for people, and their expectations are that things are going well, and then, all of a sudden, they're laid off, and nowhere to go, and now because there's such a surplus of employees in the market, and not enough jobs to hire a lot of those guys, it's created a huge problem for us.
Well, and it kills morale and positivity as well. Like, if I would think if I was a game dev and, you know, I'm trying to get employed at these numerous companies, in the back of my mind, I'd be like, when could I be laid off a year after getting employed? Like, what's going to happen?
Yeah.
Yeah, you've always got this false, like, sense of security. Like, you're never really content, I feel, which would make it harder to be more positive and want to concentrate and really give it your all if
Yeah,
you feel like there's a
absolutely.
possibility that the company might screw you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's definitely, something that impacts morale and company psychology. I mean, at a previous company I worked at, we kind of had some issues like that. People were, people had found out, I guess, what was it? People had found out like burn rate or something like that, and started to create that kind of worry, like, oh man, that's a lot of, our burn rate is a lot. Are we going to be able to survive? Am I going to be here 6 months from now? And it definitely affected morale and the way people work, because, if they can't see, if you can't see a positive future when you're working at a place, it's hard to feel good about, like, whatever project you're working on, and you don't want to give it your best, because, you kind of develop a negative attitude. Because who knows, the future looks pretty glum, so
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
I know of a few devs who've been so stressed out, you know, from this whole thing. You know, they've ended up in hospital. Some of them have had heart attacks. I mean, luckily they're still alive, but like this is a real big problem. And there
Yeah, and
doesn't seem
it's,
to be anybody that's willing to fix it.
yeah, I'm sure there are, but
There are,
like the
but you
big,
probably just don't hear about them
well, the
because all the
problem is, like,
negativity
how
gets.
do we invest in those people, right? We need to, we need to invest in those people. There are a lot of people out there who could do a good job of running studios and who are going to make good games and things like that. But again, it's like, those guys are innovating and it's a little bit more of a risk. So, we have to get to a point where, investment capital is interested in taking more of a risk. Right.
It's all about short-term profits as
Yeah.
well,
Yeah.
as opposed
Yeah.
to the longevity of a company. I mean,
Yeah.
Nintendo has survived because they really think long-term and they protect their IP, you know.
Yeah. And they do things like, oh, when the company's hurting, the principals take a salary
Exactly.
cut.
You would never, that would never happen in the West, ever.
Never. Never.
Never happened. In
So.
fact, they'd probably get a pay rise. They'd lay people off and get some bonus approved by the board or something.
Yeah, oh, so terrible.
Yeah. It makes no sense. I've never
Yeah.
understood it.
Yeah, I'm hoping things improve, because I mean, right now things just don't look great, and games is such a great industry, and there's so many great people out there. Like, I've worked with some really amazing people, not only their talent, but just some really cool people, and I know there's a lot out there, so it's I just hope it, it's able to recover, and we can kind of, shift from this ideology of like formulas and matching the spreadsheets and making sure that we hit our bottom lines, and move to something more about, like, this is fun. I know it's fun, and because it's fun, it's going to make money. It's been proven since games started. That's why we're here, is because people found games fun and they spent money on it, right?
That's right. Yeah. And I having because there's a number of American devs now that are in Kyoto, right? And you're in contact with these people. Is
Some
this
of them, yeah.
some of them, yeah. But is this the sort of discussion that comes up within these sort of circles when you guys talk about this sort of thing? Yeah.
Yeah, we actually had a meetup last Saturday, and we're talking about, these same kinds of things.
Yeah.
But it's, it's the same conversation that we're having now,
Yeah.
Like,
Yeah.
everyone's aware of it. Like, the devs are aware of it. And most people, have consensus on what the problem is. So it's not really, it's not really rocket science. You know, that's what I'm saying. Like, there's people out there, you know, that could be able to run a company and make it successful and also make fun games at the same time being profitable. But it's like, again, you know, we have to, you know, we have to, investors have to be able to want to take a risk, you know, at fun, instead of like, you know, what we know is profitable. You know, that's easy. Like, you know, you can, you know, release FIFA 2025 or whatever, and you know, like, people are gonna buy it, right? So like, that's, you know, that's fine, that's easy money, but there's no innovation there. Like, you know, there's no new gameplay.
Well, it feels like the game industry is falling into the same trap as the film industry. Like the exact same trap, where it's having to rely on, remakes and remasters and recycling the same IP, over and over. And even with the PS5 and PS4, there's not really that much difference, I feel. They're really just pushing graphics more and I suppose frame rate, but in terms of actual innovation, as you say, it's quite rare, or it's becoming a rarity. I don't know if you feel the same.
Yeah, totally. And honestly, I mean, I love all the cool new hardware and all the
Oh, yeah, of
amazing
course you would.
things. The graphics, you know, the graphics are amazing. And but, you know, the graphics by themselves are pretty, but, you know, pretty is not fun.
That's
You
right.
know, pretty is pretty, but pretty is not fun.
Yeah, that's
So,
right.
like, let's, you know, let's get back to making this stuff fun and innovating and, you know, creating original gameplay and doing something cool, you
Yeah.
know.
Well, Sean, this has been a pleasure. I will wrap up there, but before we wrap up, is there any plugs you want to do or want to give a shout out to anyone or tell us what you're working on now?
No,
No.
secret project. I am working on things. I do still like games. Would love to be able to release something, but currently working on sandbox prototypes right now.
Nice.
Shout out to all the amazing, cool people that I've worked with in the industry, and you know, that have opened doors for me and been, you know, such a big part of my career. And you know, also shout out to all the cool creative guys who are waiting for their big shot. I hope you guys get it. Just hang in there. But
Yeah.
yeah, this has been great. Thanks for having me on.
No problem, no problem. Given you're in Kyoto, would you ever want to do something for Nintendo, or are you kind of like, nah, I'm doing my own thing?
You know, Nintendo is kind of one of those dreams. I'd love to work for Nintendo, but from what I understand, it's probably, you know, it's
They're very
the
hard to get into, I've heard.
Nintendo Kyoto is very hard to get into, and they were also a very traditional Japanese company, from what I understand. I've heard that they're a little bit easier on, you know, American folks, or you know, gaijin. So yeah, I don't know. I'd have to see, but I mean, you know,
Who
from
knows? Yeah.
a as a kid, Nintendo was always kind of a dream. So yeah, I may be even willing, you know, willing to worth it even if it was difficult. So,
Yeah. Oh, well, maybe you could have lunch or something with the devs. Who knows?
yeah, totally. But
Yeah.
yeah, I hear it's a really cool place. But yeah, like you said, very hard to get into. Yeah, very Japanese work environment. So
Yeah.
yeah, love Nintendo though.
Yeah, love Nintendo. Good way to end it.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, that is the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe. And until next time, stay safe. See you later.